George got very nervous.
"What does this undercover pal of yours look like?"
George sneered in an attempt at bravery.
"He is small and elusive."
Ignatius's voice was cunning.
"He is given to many disguises. He is a veritable will-o'-the-wisp, scurrying here and there in his never-ending search for marauders. For a while he chose the covert of a bathroom, but now is out on the streets where he remains at my beck and call every minute."
George's throat filled with something that choked him.
"This is a frame-up," he swallowed.
"That's enough from you, you gutter-snipe. Encouraging the degeneration of some noble woman's scholar,"
Ignatius barked.
"You should be kissing the hem of my uniform in gratitude for my not advising Sherlock Mancuso of your evil goods. Meet me before the RKO Orpheum in 2 hours."
Ignatius bellowed grandly off down Common Street. George put his 2 packages in the bun compartment and sat down on the curb. This was really luck, meeting a pal of Mancuso's. The big vendor really had him. He looked furiously at the wagon. Now he wasn't only stuck with the packages, he was stuck with a big hot dog wagon. Ignatius tossed money at the cashier and literally lunged into the Orpheum, waddling down the aisle toward the footlights. His timing had been perfect. The second feature was just beginning. The boy with the magnificent photographs was definitely a find. Ignatius wondered if he could blackmail him into watching the wagon every afternoon. The urchin had certainly responded to his mention of a friend on the police force. Ignatius snorted at the movie credits. All of the people involved in the film were equally unacceptable. A set designer, in particular, had appalled him too many times in the past. The heroine was even more offensive than she had been in the circus musical. In this film, she was a bright young secretary whom an aged man of the world was trying to seduce. He flew her in a private jet to Bermuda and installed her in a suite. On their first night together, she broke out in a rash just as the libertine was opening her bedroom door.
"Filth!"
Ignatius shouted, spewing wet popcorn over several rows.
"How dare she pretend to be a virgin! Look at her degenerate face! Rape her!"
"They sure got some funny people at matinees,"
a lady with a shopping bag said to her companion.
"Just take a look at him. He's got on an earring."
Then there was a soft focus love scene, and Ignatius began to lose control. He could feel the hysteria overtaking him. He tried to be silent, but he found that he couldn't.
"They're photographing them through several thicknesses of cheesecloth,"
he spluttered.
"Oh my God! Who can imagine how wrinkled and loathsome those two really are? I think I'm getting nauseated. Can't someone in the projection booth turn off the electricity? Please!"
He rattled his cutlass loudly against the side of his seat. An old usherette came down the aisle and tried to grab the cutlass from him, but Ignatius wrestled with her, and she slid to the carpet. She got up and hobbled away. The heroine, believing her honor to be in question, had a series of paranoid fantasies in which she was lying on a bed with her libertine. The bed was pulled through the streets and floated across a swimming pool at the resort hotel.
"Good grief! Is this smut supposed to be comedy?"
Ignatius demanded in the darkness.
"I have not laughed once. My eyes can hardly believe this highly discolored garbage. That woman must be lashed until she drops. She is undermining our civilization. She is a Chinese communist agent sent over to destroy us. Please! Someone with some decency get to the fuse box. Hundreds of people in this theater are being demoralized. If we're all lucky, the Orpheum may have forgotten to pay its electric bill."
As the film ended, Ignatius cried,
"Under her all-American face, she is really Tokyo Rose!"
He wanted to stay for another showing, but he remembered the waif. Ignatius didn't want to ruin a good thing. He needed that boy. Weakly, he climbed over the 4 empty popcorn boxes that had accumulated before his seat during the movie. He was completely enervated. His emotions were spent. Gasping, he staggered up the aisle and out onto the sunlit street. There, by the cab stand at the Roosevelt Hotel, George was keeping a surly watch over the wagon.
"Jesus!" he sneered. "I thought you was never coming out of there. What kind of appointment you had?
You just went to see a movie.
Please, Ignatia sighed. I've just been through trauma. Run along. I'll meet you at one shop tomorrow at Canal and Royal.
Okay, Prof.
George took his packages and started to slouch away.
Keep your mouth shut, huh?
We shall see,
Ignatia said sternly. He ate a hot dog with trembling hands and peeked down into his pocket at the photograph. From above, the woman's figure looked even more matronly and reassuring. Some broken professor of Roman history? A ruined medievalist? If only she had shown her face. There was an air of solitude, of detachment, of solitary sensual and scholarly pleasure that appealed to him greatly. He looked at the scrap of wrapping paper, at the crude, tiny address. Bourbon Street. The undone woman was in the hands of commercial exploiters. What a challenging character for the journal. That particular work, Ignatius thought, was rather lacking in the sensual department. It needed a good injection of lip-smacking innuendo. Perhaps the confessions of this woman would perk it up a bit. Ignatius rolled down into the quarter, and in a wild and very fleeting moment, pondered an affair. How Myrna would gnaw at her espresso cup rim in envy. He would describe every lush moment with this scholarly woman. With her background and Boethian worldview, she would take a very stoic and fatalistic view of whatever sexual gaucheries and blunders he committed. She would be understanding.
Be kind, Ignatius would sigh to her.
Myrna probably attacked sex with the vehemence and seriousness that she brought to social protest. How anguished she would be when Ignatius described his tender pleasures.
Do I dare?
Ignatius asked himself, bumping the wagon absent-mindedly into a parked car. The handle sank into his stomach and he belched. He would not tell the woman how he came across her. First, he would discuss Boethius. She would be overwhelmed. Ignatius found the address and said,
Oh my God! The poor woman is in the hands of fiends!
He studied the facade of the Night of Joy and lumbered up to the poster in the glass case. He read, Roberta E. Lee presents Harlot O'Hara, the Virginie Belle, and Pet. Who was Harlot O'Hara? Even more important, what kind of pet? Ignatius was intrigued. Afraid of attracting the wrath of the Nazi proprietress, he sat down uncomfortably on the curb and decided to wait. Lana Lee was watching Darlene and the bird. They were almost ready to open. Now, if only Darlene could get that line straight. She wandered away from the stage, gave Joan some additional directions about cleaning under the stools, and went to look out of the porthole of glass in the padded door. She'd seen enough of the act for one afternoon. The act was really pretty good in its own way. George was really bringing in the money with the new merchandise. Things were looking good. Two, Joan seemed to be broken in at last. Lana pushed the door open and hollered out into the street,
Hey, you! Get off my curb, you character!
Please!
A rich voice answered from the street, pausing to think of some excuse.
I am only resting my rather broken feet.
Go rest them someplace else. Get that crappy wagon away from in front of my business.
Let me assure you that I did not choose to collapse here before your gas chamber of a den. I did not return here of my own volition. My feet have simply ceased to function. I'm paralyzed.
Go get paralyzed down the block. All I need is you hanging around here to ruin my investment. You look like a queer with that earring. People will think this is a gay bar. Go on.
People will never make that mistake. Without a doubt, you operate the most dismal bar in the city. May I interest you in purchasing a hot dog?
Darlene came to the door and said,
Well, look who it is. How's your poor mama?
Oh, my God! Ignatius bellowed. Why did Fortuna lead me to this spot?
Hey, Jones, Lana Lee called. Quit knocking that broom and come chase this character away.
Sorry, bounce away start at $50 a week.
You sure treat your poor mama cruel,
Darlene said out the door.
I don't imagine that either of you ladies has read Boethius, Ignatius sighed.
Don't talk to him, Lana said to Darlene. He's a fucking smart aleck. Jones, I'll give you about 2 seconds to come out here before I get you picked up on a vagrancy rap along with this character. I'm getting fed up with smartasses in general.
Goodness knows what stormtrooper will descend upon me and beat Miss Enthless, Ignatius observed coolly. You can't frighten me. I've already had my trauma for the day.
Woo-wee!
Jones said when he looked out the door.
The Green Cap Mother, in person, live!
I see that you've wisely decided to hire a particularly terrifying Negro to protect you against your enraged and cheated customers,
the Green Cap Mother said to Lana Lee. Hustle him off, Lana said to Jones.
Whoa! How you hustle off an elephant?
Look at those dark glasses. No doubt his system is swimming in dope.
Get the hell back in there, Lana said to Darlene, who was staring at Ignatius. She pushed Darlene and said to Jones, Okay, get him.
Get out your razor and slash me,
Ignatius said as Lana and Darlene went in.
Throw lye in my face. Stab me. You wouldn't realize, of course, that it was my interest in civil rights which led to my becoming a crippled vendor of Franks. I lost a particularly successful position because of my stand on the racial question. My broken feet are the indirect result of my sensitive social conscience.
Whoa! Leave a pan kick your ass out for trying to get all them poor color people thrown in jail, huh?
How do you know about that? Ignatius asked guardedly. Were you involved in that particularly abortive coup?
No. I hear people's talking around.
You did?
Ignatius asked interestedly.
No doubt they made some mention of my carriage and bearing. Thus, I am recognizable. I hardly suspected that I have become a legend. Perhaps I abandoned that movement too hastily.
Ignatius was delighted. This was developing into a bright day after many bleak ones.
I have probably become a martyr of sorts.
He belched.
Would you care for a hot dog? I extend the same courteous service to all colors and creeds. Paradise Vendors has been a pioneer in the field of public accommodations.
How come a white cat like you, talking so good, selling weenies?
Please blow your smoke elsewhere. My respiratory system, unfortunately, is below par. I suspect that I am the result of particularly weak conception on the part of my father. His sperm was probably emitted in a rather offhand manner.
This was luck, Jones thought. The fat mother dropped out of the sky just when he needed him most.
You must be out of your mind, man. You ought to have you a good job, big Buick, all that shit. Whoa! Air condition, color TV?
I have a very pleasant occupation, Ignatius answered icily. Outdoor work, no supervision. The only pressure is on the feet.
If I go to college, I wouldn't be dragging no meat wagon around selling people a lot of garbage and shit.
Please! Paradise products are of the very highest quality.
Ignatius wrapped his cutlass against the curb.
Anyone employed by that dubious bar is not in a position to question another's occupation.
Shit, you think I like the night of joy? Ooh-wee! I want to get someplace. I like to get someplace good, be gainfully employed, make me a living wage.
Just as I suspected, Ignatius said angrily. In other words, you want to become totally bourgeois. You people have all been brainwashed. I imagine that you'd like to become a success or something equally vile.
Hey, now you get me. Whoa!
I really don't have the time to discuss the errors of your value judgments. However, I would like some information from you. Do you by any chance have a woman in that den who is given to reading?
Yeah. She all the time slipping me something to read, telling me I be improving myself. She pretty decent.
Oh, my God.
The blue and yellow eyes flashed.
Is there any way that I can meet this paragon?
Jones wondered what this was all about. He said,
Whoa! You want to see her? You come around some night, see her dancing with her pet?
Good grief! Don't tell me that she is this harlot O'Hara.
Yeah, she harlot O'Hara, all right.
Boethius plus a pet, Ignatius mumbled. What a discovery.
She be open in a couple of 3 days, man. You ought to get your ass down here. This is the very finest act I ever seen. Whoa!
I can only imagine,
Ignatius said respectfully. Some brilliant satire on the decadent old South being cast before the unaware swine in the Night of Joy audience. Poor harlot.
Tell me, what sort of pet does she have?
Hey, I can't tell you that, man. You gotta see for yourself. This act a big surprise. Harlot got something to say, too. This ain't just a regular strip act. Harlot talking.
Good heavens, some incisive commentary which no one in her audiences could fully comprehend. He must see Harlot. They must communicate.
There is one thing I would like to know, sir, Ignatius said. Is the Nazi proprietress of this cesspool around here every night?
Who? Miss Lee? No.
Joan smiled at himself. The sabotage was working too perfectly. The fat mother really wanted to come to the Night of Joy.
She say Holla O'Hara so perfect, she so fine, she don't have to be coming around at night to supervise. She say just as soon Holla be opening, she living for a vacation in California. Whoa!
What luck, Ignatius slobbered. Well, I shall be here to see Miss O'Hara's act. You may secretly reserve a ringside table for me. I must see and hear everything she does.
Ooh-wee! You be real welcome, man. Drag your ass over in a couple of days. We give you the finest service in the house.
Jones, are you talking to that character or what?
Lana demanded from the door.
Don't worry, Ignatius told her. I'm leaving. Your henchman has terrified me completely. I shall never make the mistake of even passing by this vile pigsty.
Good,
Lana said, and swung the door closed. Ignatius gloated at Jones conspiratorially.
Hey, listen, Jones said. Before you be leaving, tell me something. What do you think a color cat can do to stop being a vagrant or employed below the minimum wage?
Please.
Ignatius fumbled through his smock to find the curb and raise himself.
You can't possibly realize how confused you are. Your value judgments are all wrong. When you get to the top, or wherever it is that you want to go, you'll have a nervous breakdown or worse.
Do you know of any Negroes with ulcers?
Of course not. Live contentedly in some hovel. Thank Fortuna that you have no Caucasian parent hounding you. Read Boethius.
Who? Read what?
Boethius will show you that striving is ultimately meaningless, that we must learn to accept. Ask Miss O'Hara about him.
Listen, how are you like being vagrant half the time?
Wonderful. I myself was a vagrant in happier, better days. If only I were in your shoes, I would stir from my room only once a month to fumble for my relief check in the mailbox. Realize your good fortune.
The fat mother was really a freak. The poor people at Levy Pan's were lucky that they hadn't ended up in Angola.
Well, be sure you come around in a couple of nights.
Jones blew a cloud at the earring.
Holly be doing her stuff.
I shall be there with bells on,
Ignatius said happily. How Myrna would gnash her teeth.
Whoa!
Jones walked around to the front of the wagon and studied the sheet of Big Chief paper.
Look like somebody been playing tricks on you.
That is only a merchandising gimmick.
Ooh-wee! You better check it again.
Ignatius lumbered around to the prow and saw that the waif had decorated the 12 inches of paradise sign with a variety of genitals.
Oh my God!
Ignatius ripped off the sheet covered with the ballpoint graffiti.
Have I been pushing this about?
I'll be out front looking for you, Jones said. Hey!
Ignatius waved a happy paw and waddled off. At last he had a reason for earning money. Harlot O'Hara. He aimed the now denuded prow of the wagon toward the Algiers ferry ramp, where the longshoremen gathered in the afternoons. Calling, entreating, he guided the wagon into the crowd of men and succeeded in selling all of his hot dogs, courteously and effusively squirting ketchup and mustard on his sold goods with all the energy of a fireman. What a brilliant day. The signs from Fortuna were more than promising. A surprised Mr. Clyde received cheery greetings and $10 from vendor Riley, and Ignatius, his smock filled with bills from the waif and the mogul of Frankfurters, billowed onto the trolley with a glad heart. He entered the house and found his mother talking quietly on the telephone.
I've been thinking about what you said.
Mrs. Riley was whispering into the phone.
Maybe it ain't such a bad idea after all, babe. You know what I mean?
Of course it ain't,
Santa answered.
Them people at Charity can let Ignatius take him a little rest. Claude ain't gonna want no Ignatius around, sweetheart.
He likes me, huh?
Likes you? He called up this morning to ask me if I thought you was ever gonna remarry. Lord, I says, well, Claude, you gotta pop the question. We. You two having a whirlwind courtship if I ever seen one. That poor man's desperate from loneliness.
He's sure considerate,
Miss Riley breathed into the mouthpiece.
But sometimes he makes me nervous with all them communists.
What in the world are you babbling about?
Ignatius thundered in the hall.
Christ, Santa said. It sound like that Ignatius come in.
Shh,
Mrs. Riley said into the phone.
Well, listen, sweetheart. Once Claude gets married, he'll stop thinking about them communists. His mind isn't occupied is what's wrong with him. You give him some loving.
Santa!
Good grief!
Ignatius spluttered.
Are you speaking with that Battalia's strumpet?
Shut up, boy.
You better knock that Ignatius in the head,
Santa said.
I wished I was strong enough, sweetheart,
Mrs. Riley answered.
Oh, Irene, I almost forgot to tell you. Angelo come around this morning for a cup of coffee. I hardly recognized him. You ought to seen him in that wool suit. He looked like Mrs. Astor's horse. Poor Angelo. He's sure trying hard. Now he's going to all the high-class bars, he says. He'd better get him some character.
Ain't that awful,
Mrs. Riley said sadly.
What Angelo's gonna do if he gets himself kicked off the force? And him with three children to support.
There are a few challenging openings at Paradise Vendors for men with initiative and good taste,
Ignatius said.
Listen at that nut, Santa said. Aw, Irene, you better ring up the Charity, honey.
We gonna give him another chance. Maybe he'll hit the jackpot.
I don't know why I bother talking to you, girl,
Santa sighed hoarsely.
I'll see you tonight, then, about 7. Claude says he's gonna come over here. Come pick us up, and we'll take us a nice ride out to the lake for some of them good crabs. Woo, you kids sure lucky you got me for a chaperone. You two need one, especially with that Claude around.
Santa guffawed in a voice huskier than usual and hung up.
What in the world do you and that old bard babble about?
Ignatius asked.
Shut up!
Thank you. I see that things about here are as cheerful as ever.
How much money you brought in today? A quarter?
Mrs. Riley screamed. She leaped up and stuck her hand into one of the pockets of the smock and pulled out the brilliant photograph.
Ignatius!
Give that to me!
Ignatius thundered.
How dare you besmirch that magnificent image with your vintner's hands?
Mrs. Riley peeked at the photograph again and then closed her eyes. A tear crept out from beneath her closed eyelids.
I knew when you started selling them weenies you was gonna be hanging around with people like this.
What do you mean, people like this?
Ignatius asked angrily, pocketing the photograph.
This is a brilliant, misused woman. Speak of her with respect and reverence.
I don't want to speak at all,
Mrs. Riley sniffed, her lid still sealed.
Go sit in your room and write some more of your foolishness.
The telephone rang.
That must be that Mr. Levy. He already rang up here twice today.
Mr. Levy? What does that monster want?
He wouldn't tell me. Go on, crazy. Answer that. Pick up that phone.
Well, I certainly don't want to speak with him,
Ignatius thundered. He picked up the telephone, and in an assumed voice rich with Mayfair accents, said,
Yes?
Mr. Riley?
A man asked.
Mr. Riley is not here.
This is Gus Levy.
In the background, a woman's voice was saying,
Let's see what you're going to say. Another chance down the drain. A psycho escaped.
I'm terribly sorry,
Ignatius enunciated.
Mr. Riley was called out of town this afternoon on rather crucial business. Actually, he is at the State Mental Hospital in Mandeville. Since being so viciously dismissed by your concern, he has had to commute back and forth regularly from Mandeville. His ego is badly bruised. You may yet receive his psychiatrist bills. They are rather staggering.
He cracked up?
Violently and totally. We had something of a time with him here. The first time that he went to Mandeville, he had to be transported in an armored car. As you know, his physique is rather grand. This afternoon, however, he left in a state patrol ambulance.
Can he have visitors at Mandeville?
Of course. Drive out to see him. Bring him some cookies.
Ignatia slammed the telephone down, pressed a quarter into the palm of his still sniffling, blinded mother, and waddled to his room. Before opening the door, he stopped to straighten the Peace to Men of Goodwill sign that he had tacked to the peeling wood. All signs were pointing upward. His wheel was revolving skyward. Chapter 12. There had been a flurry of excitement. The wild blowing of the postman's whistle, the chugging postal truck out on Constantinople Street, his mother's excited screaming, Miss Annie's calling to the postman that his whistle had frightened her, all had interrupted Ignatius's dressing for the kickoff rally. He signed the postal delivery receipt and rushed back to his room, locking his door.
"What is it, boy?"
Mrs. Riley asked in the hall. Ignatius looked at the airmail special delivery stamping on the manila envelope and at the little handwritten pleas, urgent and rush.
"Oh, my goodness," he said happily. "The Minkoff Minx must be beside herself."
He tore open the envelope and pulled out the letter.
"Sirs, did you really send me this telegram, Ignatius?"
"Myrna, form Peace Party Central Committee Northeastern Zone at once. Stop. Organize at every level. Stop. Recruit sodomites only. Stop. Sex in politics. Stop. Details will follow. Stop. Ignatius National Chairman. Stop."
"What does this mean, Ignatius? Do you really want me to recruit fags? Who wants to be a registered sodomite? Ignatius, I am very worried. Are you hanging around with some queers? I could have guessed that this would happen. The paranoid fantasy of the arrest and accident was the first clue. Now the whole thing is out in the open. Your normal sexual outlets have been blocked for so long that now the sexual overflow is seeping out into the wrong channels. Since the fantasy, which was the beginning of it all, you have been undergoing a period of crisis which is culminating in overt sexual aberration. I could tell that you were going to flip sooner or later. Now it has happened. My group therapy group will really be depressed when they hear that your case has taken a turn for the worse. Please leave that decaying city and come north. Call me Collect if you want to, and we can talk over this problem of sexual orientation that you are having. You must have therapy soon, or you will become a screaming queen."
"How dare she?" Ignatius bellowed.
"Whatever happened to the Divine Right Party? I had several people who were all ready to join. I don't know if they'll go for the sodomite business, although I can see that we might use this sodomite party to drain off the fringe group fascists. Maybe we could split the right wing in half. Still, I don't think this is a good idea at all. Suppose non-sodomites want to join and we refuse. We will be accused of being prejudiced and the whole thing will flop." The lecture was not exactly a success, I'm afraid. It went over all right. Right over the people's heads. There were two or three middle-aged people in the audience who tried to heckle me with these very hostile remarks, but a couple of my friends from the group therapy group challenged them hostility for hostility and finally drove those reactionaries out of the auditorium. Just as I suspected, I was a little too advanced for the neighborhood audience. Onga did not show up, that crumb. As far as I'm concerned, they can send him back to Africa. I really thought that guy had something on the ball. Apparently he's very apathetic politically. He promised me he would be there, that schmuck. Ignatius, this sodomite plan does not sound very practical at all. In addition, I think it is only a dangerous manifestation of your declining mental health. I don't know how I can tell my group therapy group about this weird development, however predictable it might have been. The group has been really pulling for you all along. Some are even identifying with you. If you go, they might go too. I need immediate communication from you. Please call Collect any time after 6 p.m. I am very, very worried. M. Minkoff."
"She is totally confounded," Ignatius said happily. "Wait until she hears of my apocalyptic meeting with Miss O'Hara."
"Ignatius, what's that you got?"
"A communication from Myrna Minx."
"What that girl wants?"
"She is threatening suicide unless I swear that my heart is hers alone."
"Ain't that awful?"
I bet you've been telling that poor girl a lot of lies. I know you, Ignatius.
Behind the door, there were sounds of dressing. Something that sounded like a piece of metal fell to the floor.
Where are you going to?
Miss Riley asked the peeling paint.
Please, Mother,
a basso profundo voice answered.
I'm rather rushed. Stop bothering me, please.
You might as well stay at home all day long for all the money you're bringing in,
Mrs. Riley screamed at the door.
How am I going to meet the note I got to pay that man?
I wish that you would let me alone. I'm addressing a political meeting tonight, and I must organize my thoughts.
A political meeting? Ignatius, ain't that wonderful? Maybe you'll make good in politics, boy. You got you a fine voice. What club, honey? The Crescent City Democrats? The old regulars?
The party is secret at the moment, I'm afraid.
What kind of political party's secret?
Mrs. Riley asked suspiciously.
Are you going to talk with a bunch of communists?
Ho-hum.
Somebody give me some pamphlets on the communists, boy. I've been reading all about the communists. Don't try to fool me, Ignatius.
Yes, I saw one of those pamphlets in the hall this afternoon. You either dropped it there on purpose so that I could benefit from its message, or you tossed it there accidentally during your regular afternoon wine orgy in the belief that it was a particularly elephantine bit of confetti. I imagine that your eyes have some trouble focusing at about 2 in the afternoon. Well, I read through the pamphlet. It's almost completely illiterate. Goodness knows where you get such garbage. Probably from the old woman who sells pralines at the cemetery. Well, I am not a communist, so let me alone.
Ignatius, don't you think maybe you'd be happy if you went and took you a little rest at charity?
Are you referring to the psychiatric ward by any chance?
Ignatius demanded in a rage.
Do you think that I am insane? Do you suppose that some stupid psychiatrist could even attempt to fathom the workings of my psyche?
You could just rest, honey. You could write some stuff in your little copybooks.
They would try to make me into a moron who liked television and new cars and frozen food. Don't you understand? Psychiatry is worse than communism. I refuse to be brainwashed. I won't be a robot.
But, Ignatius, they help out a lot of people got problems.
Do you think that I have a problem?
Ignatius bellowed.
The only problem that those people have, anyway, is that they don't like new cars and hairsprays. That's why they are put away. They make the other members of the society fearful. Every asylum in this nation is filled with poor souls who simply cannot stand lanolin, cellophane, plastic, television, and subdivisions.
Ignatius, that ain't true. You remember old Mr. Banknell used to live down the block? They locked him up because he was running down the street naked.
Of course he was running down the street naked. His skin could not bear any more of that Dacron and nylon clothing that was clogging his pores. I've always considered Mr. Becknell one of the martyrs of our age. The poor man was badly victimized. Now run along to the front door and see if my taxi has arrived.
Where are you getting money for a taxi?
I keep a few pennies stuffed in my mattress,
Ignatius answered. He had blackmailed another $10 out of the urchin, also forcing the waif to watch the wagon while he spent the afternoon at Lowe's State watching a film about drag-racing teenagers. The guttersnipe was definitely a discovery, a gift sent by Fortuna to make amends for all of her bad spins.
Go peek through the shutters.
The door creaked open, and Ignatius appeared in his pirate finery.
Ignatius!
I thought that you might react like that. Therefore, I have kept all of this paraphernalia stashed at Paradise Vendors, Incorporated.
Angelo was right,
Mrs. Riley cried.
You've been out on the streets dressed up like a Mardi Gras all this time.
A scarf here, a cutlass there, one or two deft and tasteful suggestions, that's all. The total effect is rather fetching.
You can't go out like that,
Mrs. Riley hollered.
Please, not another hysterical scene. You'll dislodge all of the thoughts which are developing in my mind in connection with the lecture.
Get back in that room, boy!
Mrs. Riley began beating Ignatius on the arms.
Get back in there, Ignatius! I ain't fooling this time, boy! You can't disgrace me like that!
Good heavens! Mother, stop that! I'll be in no condition for my speech.
What kind of speech you gonna make? Where you going to, Ignatius? Tell me, boy!
Mrs. Riley slapped her son flatly in the face.
You ain't leaving this house crazy.
Oh, my God! Are you going mad? Get away from me this instant. I hope that you've noticed that scimitar dangling from my uniform.
A slap struck Ignatius in the nose. Another landed on his right eye. He waddled down the hall, pushed the long shutters open, and ran out into the yard.
Come back in this house!
Mrs. Riley screamed from the front door.
You ain't going nowhere, Ignatius!
I dare you to come out in that shredded nightgown and get me!
Ignatius answered defiantly and stuck out his massive pink tongue.
Get back in here, Ignatius!
Hey, knock it off, you two!
Miss Annie shouted from behind her front shutters.
My nerves are shot to hell!
Take a look at Ignatius,
Mrs. Riley called to her.
Ain't that awful?
Ignatius was waving to his mother from the brick sidewalk, his earring catching the rays of the streetlight.
Ignatius, come in here like a good boy,
Mrs. Riley pleaded.
I already got me a headache from the goddamn postman's whistle,
Miss Annie threatened loudly.
I'm gonna ring up the cops in about 1 minute. Ignatius,
shouted Mrs. Riley, but it was too late. A taxi was cruising down the block. Ignatius flagged it down, just as his mother, forgetting the disgrace of the shredded nightgown, ran down to the curb. Ignatius slammed the rear door right in his mother's maroon hair and barked an address at the driver. He stabbed at his mother's hands with a cutlass and ordered the driver to move along immediately. The taxi sped off, churning up some pebbles in the gutter that stung Mrs. Riley's legs through the torn rayon gown. She watched the red taillights for a moment, then she ran back into the house to telephone Santa.
Going to a costume party, pal?
The driver asked Ignatius as they turned onto St. Charles Avenue.
Watch where you're going and speak when you're spoken to,
Ignatius thundered. During the ride, the driver said nothing else, but Ignatius practiced his speech loudly in the back seat, rapping his cutlass against the front seat to emphasize certain key points. At St. Peter Street, he got out and first heard the noise, dim yet frenetic singing and laughing coming from the three-story stucco building. Some prosperous Frenchman had built the house in the late 1700s to house a menage of wife, children, and spinster tantes. The tantes had been stored up in the attic, along with the other excess and unattractive furniture, and from the two little dormer windows in the roof they had seen what little of the world they believed existed outside of their own mond of slanderous gossip, needlework, and cyclical recitations of the rosary. But the hand of the professional decorator had exorcised whatever ghost of the French bourgeoisie might still haunt the thick brick walls of the building. The exterior was painted a bright canary yellow. The gas jets and the reproduction brass lanterns mounted on either side of the carriageway flickered softly, their amber flames rippling in reflection on the black enamel of the gate and shutters. On the flagstone paving beneath both lanterns, there were old plantation pots in which Spanish daggers grew and extended their sharply pointed stilettos. Ignatius stood before the building, regarding it with extreme distaste. His blue and yellow eyes denounced the resplendent facade. His nose rebelled against the very noticeable odor of fresh enamel. His ears shrank from the bedlam of singing, cackling, and giggling that was going on behind the closed black patent leather shutters. Testily clearing his throat, he looked at the three brass doorbells and at the little white cards above each. Billy Truehard, Raoul Frail, 3A. Frida Club, Betty Bumper, Liz Steele, 2A. Dorian Green, 1A. He jabbed a finger into the bottom bell and waited. The frenzy behind the shutters abated very slightly. A door opened somewhere down the carriageway, and Dorian Green came walking toward the gate.
Oh, dear,
he said when he saw who was out on the sidewalk.
Where in the world have you been? I'm afraid that the kickoff rally is fast getting out of hand. I have tried unsuccessfully once or twice to call the group to order, but apparently feelings are running rather high.
I hope you've done nothing to dampen their morale,
Ignatius said gravely, tapping his cutlass impatiently on the iron gate. He noticed somewhat angrily that Dorian was walking toward him a little unsteadily. This was not what he had expected.
Oh, what a gathering,
Dorian said as he opened the gate.
Everyone is simply letting his hair down.
Dorian did a rapid and uncoordinated pantomime to illustrate this.
Oh, my God, Ignatius said. Stop that appalling obscenity.
Several people will be completely ruined after this evening. There's going to be a mass exodus from Mexico City in the morning. But then Mexico City is so wonderfully wild.
I certainly hope that no one has tried to inflict any warmongering resolutions upon the gathering.
Oh, goodness, no.
I'm relieved to hear that. Heaven knows what opposition we may have to face, even at the outset. We may have some enemy within. Word may have leaked out to the whole military combine of the nation, and for that matter, the world.
Well, come along, Gypsy Queen, let's get inside. As they walked down the carriageway, Ignatius said,
"This building is repellently flamboyant."
He looked at the pastel lamps concealed behind the palms along the walls.
"Who's responsible for this abortion?"
"I, of course, Magyar Maiden. I own the building."
"I should have known. May I ask where the money comes from to support this decadent whimsy of yours?"
"From my dear family out there in the wheat," Dorian sighed. "They send me large checks every month. In return, I simply guarantee them that I'll stay out of Nebraska. I left there under something of a cloud, you see. All that wheat and those endless plains, I can't tell you how depressing it was. Grant Wood romanticized it, if anything. I went east for college and then came here. Oh, New Orleans is such freedom."
"Well, at least we have a gathering place for our coup. Now that I've seen the place, however, I would have preferred your renting an American Legion hall or something equally appropriate. This place looks more like the setting for some perverted activity, like a tea dance or a garden party."
"Do you know that a national home decorating magazine wants to do a 4-page color spread on this building?" Dorian asked.
"If you had any sense, you would realize that that is the ultimate insult,"
Ignatius snorted. "Oh, girl with the golden earring, you are driving me out of my mind. Look, here's the door."
"Just a moment," Ignatius said cautiously. "What is that awful noise? It sounds as if someone's being sacrificed."
They stood in the pastel light of the carriageway, listening. Somewhere in the patio, a human was crying in distress. "Oh, dear, what are they doing now?" Dorian's voice was impatient. "Those little fools. They never can behave themselves."
"I would suggest that we investigate,"
Ignatius said, his voice a conspiratorial whisper. "Some obsessed military officer may have slipped into the meeting incognito and may be trying to extricate our secrets from some faithful party member by means of torture. The dedicated military will stoop to anything. It could even be some foreign agent."
"Oh, what fun!"
Dorian shrieked. He and Ignatius tripped and waddled to the patio. There, someone was crying for help in the slave quarters. The door of the slave quarters was slightly ajar, but Ignatius threw himself against it anyway, shattering several panes of glass.
"Oh, my God!"
he screamed when he saw what was before him.
"They have struck!"
He looked at the little sailor shackled and chained to the wall. It was Timmy.
"Do you see what you've done to my door?"
Dorian was asking behind Ignatius.
"The enemy is among us,"
Ignatius said wildly.
"Who tattled? Tell me! Someone is on to us!"
"Oh, get me out of here,"
the little sailor pleaded.
"It's awfully dark."
"You little fool,"
Dorian spat at the sailor.
"Who chained you in here?"
"It was that terrible Billy and Raoul. They're so awful, those two. They brought me out here to show me how you're redecorating the slave quarters, and the next thing I knew, they locked me in these dirty chains and ran back into the party."
The little sailor rattled his chains.
"I've just had this place redone," Dorian said to Ignatius. "Oh, my door."
"Where are those agents?"
Ignatius demanded, unpinning his cutlass and waving it about.
"We must apprehend them before they leave this building."
"Please get me out. I can't stand the dark."
"It's your fault this door is broken,"
Dorian hissed at the deranged mariner.
"Playing games with those two tramps from upstairs."
"He broke the door."
"What can you expect from him? Just look at him." "Are you two deviants talking about me?"
Ignatius asked angrily.
"If you're going to get this excited about a door, I seriously doubt whether you'll survive for long in the vicious arena of politics."
"Oh, get me out of here. I'm going to scream if I stay in these tacky chains much longer."
"Oh, shut up, Nelly,"
Dorian snapped, slapping Timmy across his pink cheeks.
"Get out of my house and go back on the streets where you belong."
"Oh,"
the sailor cried.
"What a terrible thing to say."
"Please," Ignatius cautioned. "The movement must not be sabotaged by internal strife."
I did think that I had at least one friend left,
the sailor said to Dorian.
I see I was wrong. Go ahead. Slap me again if it give you so much pleasure.
I wouldn't even touch you, you little tramp.
I doubt whether any hack, under pressure, could pen such atrocious melodrama,
Ignatius observed.
Now stop all of this, you two degenerates. Exercise at least a little taste and decency.
Slap me,
the sailor shrieked.
I know you're dying to do it. You'd love to hurt me, wouldn't you?
Apparently, he won't settle down until you've agreed to inflict at least a little physical injury upon him,
Ignatius told Dorian. I wouldn't put a finger on his stupid slut body.
Well, we must do something to silence him. My valve can take only so much of this deranged mariner's neuroses. We shall have to politely drop him from the movement. He simply does not measure up. Anyone can smell that heavy musk of masochism which he exudes. It's sneaking up the slave quarters at this very moment. In addition, he appears rather drunk.
You hate me too, you big monster!
The sailor screamed at Ignatius. Ignatius tapped Timmy soundly on the head with his cutlass, and the seafarer emitted a little moan.
Goodness knows what debased fantasy he's having,
Ignatius commented.
Oh, hit him again, Dorian chirped happily. What fun! Please let me out of these awful chains, the sailor pleaded. My sailor suit's getting all rusty.
While Dorian was unlocking the shackles with a key he took from over the door, Ignatius said,
You know, manacles and chains have functions in modern life which their fevered inventors must never have considered in an earlier and simpler age. If I were a suburban developer, I would attach at least one set to the walls of every new yellow brick ranch style and Cape Cod split level. When the suburbanites grew tired of television and ping-pong or whatever they do in their little homes, they could chain one another up for a while. Everyone would love it. Wives would say, My husband put me in chains last night. It was wonderful. Has your husband done that to you lately? And children would hurry eagerly home from school to their mothers who would be waiting to chain them. It would help the children to cultivate the imagination denied them by television and would appreciably cut down on the incidence of juvenile delinquency. When father came in from work, the whole family could grab him and chain him for being stupid enough to be working all day long to support them. Troublesome old relatives would be chained in the carport. Their hands would be released only once a month so they could sign over their social security checks. Manacles and chains could build a better life for all. I must give this some space in my notes and jottings.
Oh, my dear, Dorian sighed. Don't you ever shut up.
My arms are all rusty, Timmy said. Just wait till I get my hands on that Billy and Raoul.
Our little convention seems to be getting rather unwieldy,
Ignatius said of the mad noises issuing from Dorian's apartment.
Apparently, feeling about the issues is striking more than one nerve center.
Oh, heavens, I'd rather not look, Dorian said, pushing the glass-paneled wisp of a French provincial door open. Inside, Ignatius saw a seething mass of people. Cigarettes and cocktail glasses held like batons flew in the air, directing the symphony of chatter, shrieking, singing, and laughing. From the bowels of a huge stereophonic phonograph, the voice of Judy Garland was fighting its way through the din. A small band of young men, the only stationary ones in the room, stood before the phonograph as if it were an altar.
Divine! Fantastic!
So human,
they were saying of the voice from their electric tabernacle. His blue and yellow eyes traveled from this right to the rest of the room, where the other guests were attacking one another with conversation. Herringbones and madras and lamb's wool and cashmere flashed past in a blur as hands and arms rent the air in a variety of graceful gestures. Fingernails, cufflinks, pinky rings, teeth, eyes, all glittered. In the center of one knot of elegant guests, a cowboy with a little riding crop flicked the crop at one of his fans, producing a response of exaggerated screaming and pleased giggling. In the center of another knot stood a lout in a black leather jacket who was teaching judo holds, to the great delight of his epicene students.
Oh, do teach me that!
Someone near the wrestler screamed after an elegant guest had been twisted into an obscene position and then thrown to the floor to land with a crash of cufflinks and other assorted jewelry. I only invited the better people, Dorian said to Ignatius.
Good gracious! Ignatius spluttered. I can see that we're going to have a great deal of trouble capturing the conservative rural redneck Calvinist vote. We are going to have to rebuild our image along lines other than those I see here.
Timmy, who was watching the black leather lout twist and dump eager partners, sighed.
How fun.
The room itself was what decorators would probably call severe. The walls and high ceilings were white, and the room itself was sparsely furnished with a few pieces of antique furniture. The only voluptuous element in the large room was the champagne-colored velvet drapes tied back with white ribbons. The two or three antique chairs had apparently been chosen for their bizarre design and not for their ability to seat anyone, for they were delicate suggestions, Kensett furniture with cushions barely capable of accommodating a child. A human in such a room was expected not to rest or sit or even relax, but rather pose, thereby transforming himself into a human furnishing that would complement the decor as well as possible. After Ignatius had studied the decor, he said to Dorian,
"The only functional item in here is that phonograph, and that is obviously being misused. This is a room with no soul."
He snorted loudly, in part over the room and in part over the fact that no one in the room had even noticed him, even though he complimented the decor as well as a neon sign would have. The participants in the kickoff rally seemed much more concerned about their own private fates this evening than they were about the fate of the world.
"I notice that no one in this whitened sepulchre of a room has so much as even looked at us. They haven't even nodded to their host, whose liquor they are consuming, and whose year-round air conditioning they are taxing with all of those overpowering colognes. I feel rather like an observer at a catfight."
"Don't worry about them. They've been simply dying for a good party for months. Come, you must see the decoration that I've made." He took Ignatius over to the mantelpiece and showed him a bud vase containing one red, one white, and one blue rose.
"Isn't that wild? It's better than all of that tacky crepe paper. I did buy some crepe paper, but nothing that I could do with it satisfied me."
"That is a floral abortion,"
Ignatius commented irritably and tapped the vase with his cutlass.
"Dyed flowers are unnatural and perverse, and, I suspect, obscene also. I can see that I'm going to have my hands full with you people."
"Oh, talk, talk, talk," Dorian moaned.
"Then let's go into the kitchen. I want you to meet the ladies' auxiliary."
"Is that true? An auxiliary?"
Ignatius asked greedily.
"Well, I must compliment you upon your foresightedness."
They entered the kitchen, where, except for two young men who were having an emotional argument in the corner, all was quiet. Seated at a table were three women drinking from beer cans. They regarded Ignatius squarely. The one who was crushing a beer can in her hand stopped and tossed the can into a potted plant next to the sink.
"Girls,"
Dorian said. The three beer girls raised a raucous Bronx cheer.
"This is Ignatius Riley, a new face."
"Put it there, fats,"
the girl who had been crushing the can said. She grabbed Ignatius's paw and worked it over as if it too were a prospect for crushing.
"Oh my God!"
Ignatius screamed.
"That's Frida," Dorian explained. "And they're Betty and Liz."
"How do you do?"
Ignatius said, slipping his hands into the pockets of his smock to prevent any further handshaking.
"I'm sure that you'll be of invaluable help to our cause." "Where did you pick him up?"
Frida asked Dorian, while her two companions studied Ignatius and nudged each other.
"Mr. Green and I met through my mother,"
Ignatius answered grandly for Dorian.
"No kidding," Frida said. "Your mother must be a very interesting person." "Hardly," Ignatius replied. "Well, grab yourself a beer, Tubby," Frida said. "I wish we had it in bottles. Betty here could open you under the teeth. She's got teeth like an iron claw."
Betty made an obscene gesture at Frida.
"And one of these days she's gonna get them all knocked down her fucking throat."
Betty hit Frida on the head with an empty can.
"You're asking for it,"
Frida said, raising one of the kitchen chairs.
"Now stop it," Dorian spat. "If you three can't behave, you can just leave right now."
"Personally," Liz said, "we're getting very bored just sitting here in the kitchen."
"Yeah!"
Betty screamed. She grabbed a rung of the chair that Frida was holding over her head, and she and Frida began wrestling for possession of it.
"How come we have to sit out here?"
"Put that chair down this minute,"
Dorian said.
Yes, please,
Ignatius added. He had retreated to a corner.
Someone will be injured.
Like you, Liz said.
She heaved an unopened beer can at Ignatius, who ducked.
Good heavens, Ignatius said. I think I shall return to the other room.
Beat it, big ass, Liz said to him. You're using up all the air in here.
Girls!
Dorian was screaming at the wrestling Frida and Betty, whose t-shirts were growing damp. They were huffing and heaving around the room with the chair, mashing each other against the wall and sink.
Okay, cut it out! Liz screamed at her friends. These people are going to think you're crude!
She picked up another chair and got between the two contestants. Then she slammed her chair down onto the one that Frida and Betty were wrestling over, knocking the girls aside. The two chairs rattled and clattered to the floor.
Who told you to butt in?
Frida demanded of Liz, grabbing her by her cropped hair. Dorian, stumbling over the chairs, tried to push the girls back to the table, snapping,
Now sit down there and be decent.
This party stinks, Betty said. Where's the action?
How come you invited us down here if all we're gonna do is sit here in this friggin' kitchen?
Frida demanded.
You'll only start brawling in there, you know it. I thought it would be a neighborly thing to do to ask you down out of courtesy. I don't want any trouble. This is the nicest party we've had in months.
Okay, Frida growled. We'll sit out here like ladies.
The girls punched one another about the arms in agreement.
After all, we're only paying tenants.
Go in there and be nice to that phony cowboy, the one that sounds like Jeanette MacDonald, the one that tried to bitch us on Shark Street the other day.
He's a very fine and friendly person, Dorian said. I'm sure he didn't see you girls.
He saw us all right, Betty said. We copped him on the head.
I'd like to kick his superior balls in, Liz said.
Please, Ignatius said importantly. All I see about me is strife. You must close ranks and present a unified front.
What's with him?
Liz asked, opening the beer can she had thrown at Ignatius. A spray of foam shot out and wet Ignatius on his distended Paradise product stomach.
Well, I've had enough of this,
Ignatius said angrily.
Good,
Frida said.
Shove off.
The kitchen is our territory tonight, Betty said. We decide who uses it.
I certainly am interested in seeing the first cherry party that the auxiliary gives,
Ignatius snorted and lumbered to the door. As he was exiting, an empty beer can struck the door frame near his earring. Dorian followed him out and closed the door.
I can't imagine how you decided to besmirch the movement by inviting those rowdies here.
I had to, Dorian explained. If you don't invite them to a party, they break in anyway. Then they're even worse. They're really fun girls when they're in a good mood, but they had some trouble with the police recently, and they're taking it out on everyone.
They shall be dropped from the movement immediately.
Anything you say, Magyara,
Dorian sighed.
I myself feel a little sorry for the girls. They used to live in California where they had a grand time. Then there was an incident about assaulting a bodybuilder at Muscle Beach. They had been Indian arm wrestling with the boy, or so they say, and then it seems that things got out of hand. They literally had to flee Southern California and dash across the desert in that magnificent German automobile of theirs. I have given them sanctuary. In many respects, they're wonderful tenants. They guard my building better than any watchdog could. They have loads of money that they get from some aging movie queen.
Really?
Ignatius asked with interest.
Perhaps I was hasty about dropping them. Political movements must get their money from whatever source they can. The girls have, no doubt, a charm which their blue jeans and boots obscure.
He looked over the seething mass of guests.
You must get these people quiet. We must bring them to order. There is crucial business at hand.
The cowboy, the phony bitch, was tickling an elegant guest with his riding crop. The black leather lout was pinning an ecstatic guest to the floor. Everywhere there were screams, sighs, shrieks. Lena Horne was now singing within the phonograph.
Clever, crisp, terribly Cosmo,
the group around the phonograph was saying reverently. The cowboy broke away from his aroused fans and began to synchronize his lips to the lyrics on the record,
slinking around the floor like a chanteuse in boots and Stetson. With a barrage of squeals, they